On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
How was the conversation? Do we show, do we visualize O'Neill's death?
And one of the first cuts of the film, you know, ended with Bill O'Neill committed suicide. That's it. And then it was, you know, credits. And people were just like, it wasn't even just get murdered. It was just Bill O'Neill committed suicide. Then the music came on and then that was it. And people were like, this is the most depressing film I've ever seen. When we were putting together the outline, yeah, we definitely thought we were going to show his death. But I think, you know, through the script and then finally getting to shooting it, it just would have
been. It would have been very expensive.
Very expensive. And I think also gruesome. And I don't know. I mean, it's one of those scenes where it's like, I like how we ended it. I think the editors and I think Shaka did a great job in just like making sure we ended on Hampton, mm-hmm. and giving his speech and just a bit more hopeful. I think it's right to leave with Hampton.
Judas and the Black Messiah is a hot new film on HBO Max about the life of Chicago Black Panther Fred Hampton and the FBI informant who snitched on him and led to him being murdered by Chicago police. It stars Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield. It is compelling, it is powerful, it is gripping. And the original story was by the Lucas brothers, who've been on this show before. I texted them, I said, let's do it again. We want to come and just talk about this film. They said, let's do it. So here we are, talking about Judas and the Black Messiah with the guys who originally came up with this idea of talking about Fred Hampton and this FBI snitch who brought him down. It's the Lucas brothers talking about Judas and the Black Messiah on Torre Show. The film is fantastic. It's deep and gripping and very interesting. I watched it twice. Lots of thoughts about it. Explain to me how this journey toward this film even began, because this was originally your idea, right?
We got into comedy around 2010, and we had always been fascinated by the Hampton story and just like, you know, the tragedy of it all and just how, you know, how young he was as a organizer and as a leader and just how like insidious it was that the state, the FBI, and the Chicago Police Department and the city apparatus in Chicago, Mayor Daley, Hammerhand, just how they conspired to assassinate him. So it was just one of those things, one of those stories that when you learn about it, you can't help but not think about it all the time. And I think it was right around 2012. I think Trayvon Martin had just been murdered and it sparked all this unrest. And we just started thinking like, how can we use our platform to tell a story that speaks to the times, but doesn't necessarily speak to the times. It speaks about an incident that happened, you know, well into the 60s. So Hampton came back to us and his story came back to us. And we were like, we need to figure out a way to turn this story into a film. So it was around 2012. We started doing more research about Hampton. We read this book called The Assassination of Fred Hampton by Jeffrey Haas, who was the lawyer of Hampton in the 60s. And then we read Black Against Empire. We read Revolutionary Suicide. We started watching a bunch of his speeches on YouTube. And we also stumbled upon this transcript of William O'Neill, when he gave his interview with the Eyes on a Prize. We had never seen the documentary. We had never seen video footage of it. We just read the transcript a bunch of times. And as we kept reading it and reading it and reading it, we were like, wait a second, this might be the framework for film, because to us, you know, it, I don't know, Kenny can probably explain more about it, but to us, when we were reading it, we were like, this feels like a crime thriller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it just sort of, the way he laid out the story, it just sort of read in a, like a sort of classic three act framework. And so we were just like, okay, this could be a good way to organize our story, knowing full well with the intentionality that this is really a narrative about COINTELPRO, about Fred Hampton, and about how the state worked to assassinate a citizen exercising his constitutional rights. So we had all that sort of baked into what we wanted to do, but we had this narrative framework that we thought could work cinematically.
Yeah, and it also felt very biblical too. You know, you have this guy who, you know, gets close to this very, you know, messianic figure. I wouldn't say he didn't see himself as Jesus, of course, but you know, when you read about him, you're like, oh man, this guy had the ability to unite, and he had strong oratory skills, and he had the ability to do things that a lot of leaders can't. And then he betrays them, then he commits suicide. So again, the framework for a story, what it just felt right for cinema.
Well, let's take a step back. So go a little deeper into why Fred Hampton. I remember hearing the story of Fred Hampton as a kid and being very moved by it. The whole story of the Panthers is deeply moving and cinematic. You know, Fred Hampton is a great charismatic character. I wonder why him and not the Oakland Panthers, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who also had similar adventures, for lack of a better word, also had FBI informants, you know, getting in with them. You could have done a similar thing around the Oakland group. So why were you, why Hampton?
I don't know. I think it was a number of things. I think there were some problematic issues with Huey P. Newton and his relationship with women and his relationship with power and his relationship with violence. And so, you know, as a person whom, and again, Huey P. Newton, I don't disrespect him. I understand his importance. I understand his contributions to the struggle. I understand, you know, his commitment. But I feel like as a character for cinema, if we're trying to, if we're having a renegotiation with our relationship and how we're portraying the Black Panthers and who we're going to make our sort of hero, I think we have to really give thought to which character we want to get behind. And I feel like Fred Hampton is just a pure person, just a nicer person, a less cult of a personality type person. And I just felt like it just worked more in the cinematic, but also philosophically speaking, I feel like I probably had more in common with Fred when I was younger, not now. I'm sure not even close to Fred Hampton, but when I was younger, I felt like I probably had more in common with Hampton than I did with Huey. And my relationship with Chicago, I just have a different relationship with Chicago than I do with Oakland. I've spent more time in Chicago than I have in Oakland. And I love Oakland. I love the Bay Area, but I have a different sort of relationship with Chicago.
Is there a story about Fred, or just sort of a way of further understanding him that didn't make it into the film, but still sort of lives in your heart of like, well, if we could have done another hour, we would have gotten into this also.
Yeah.
When, you know, when Shaka and Will first presented us the script, I mean, it was much more robust. It was like, they had like elements of like, you know, how the Panthers went about getting money to finance the hospital and finance the free breakfast program. It went into the particulars of that, which I think could be a very fascinating story in and of itself. Just like, you never really think about it, but it's like, yeah, the free breakfast program costs money.
How did they get money for the free breakfast program?
I mean, it really just like going out to businesses and seeking donations. Mm-hmm. So they would go to like various organizations that presented themselves as committed to the Black cause. And they would essentially just try to convince them to give a donation.
And also Hampton would speak at college campuses,
right,
and they get money that way to fund their various programs.
Right, right. So his speaking engagements were mostly utilized to raise money.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. So like that was baked into the script. You know, they really went into detail about how they received. That was like his own plot line, actually, receiving money to build the hospital at the end. But, wow, you know, because of time, we had to cut that out.
So you guys wrote your story about, right, Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And then you linked with Shaka, the director?
Right. Right. So, you know, around 2013, we had put together a story treatment. We put together a pitch deck. And, you know, we had it all mapped out for the most part. And we went around town. We went to various production companies, studios, and we just started, you know, we were pitching our story. And we got rejections across the board. So we tabled it for about a year, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, we were working with Bernie for a bit. We did our cartoon.
Bernie Sanders.
You know, we were 22. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders. So we were just like, we kind of just
like Bernie Mac or Bernie, no, Bernie Sanders.
Right? No, we did some, you know, some disavowal work with Bernie Mac. And
Senator Bernie Mac.
Yeah. But yeah, so we just like kind of like went away from it because we were failing so much, and we were just like, we need to rethink our approach to this, because obviously we're not able to convince these executives to give us money to make this. So we need to rethink our strategy. And we were like, I think we need to, I just looked at an email from maybe 2015. I was like, I think we need to link with a filmmaker to take us to the next level. And we were just fortunate by the graces of God to work with Shaka on this FX pilot. Mm-hmm. And he was a comedy pilot for Killer Mike. And, you know, we were on set with him for a full day, pretty much. It was a full shoot, 8 hours, maybe even 10 hours. And we got to really know him, just see like his style and his approach to directing, and he was just super laid back, and we just took a liking to him. And then we went back and watched all of his stuff, and then we were like, oh man, this guy's immensely talented. And we think that if we pitch him our idea, he'll be able to not only translate it to executives, but turn it into a cinematic gold. So, you know, but we didn't reach out to him immediately, but we just started like in the back of our heads thinking like he could be the person that takes it to the next level.
Right.
Why are you not the screenplay writers?
Oh, because we wrote the story, but they went off and wrote the screenplay. Right. We didn't write the screenplay.
So Will Burson, the other screenwriter on the screenplay, he had already written a film about Fred Hampton, and it was brilliant. It was a bit more robust than what we were coming for. It was pretty much like how he explains it. It was like Michael Mann's Heat, where, you know, you had Hoover and Fred Hampton sort of basically engaging in this dialogue with one another while not engaging in a dialogue with one another. And it was really brilliant. We all thought it was great. So that's why, you know, we were like, we need to bring him on board, because, you know, he wrote a brilliant script about Fred Hampton. We think we can use some of his scenes and some of his work in his screenplay, use our story, synthesize the two, and then now you have a screen. Now you have a screenplay that you can present to studios and execs.
I've seen a lot of you guys' work, and this is not funny. And I'm trying to see, where are the Lucas Brothers fingerprints on this? And obviously, you know, we've talked about your life before in this show. You guys are much more than just comedians. You guys were law students. You guys are philosophers. So you're way more than just stand-up. But like, so I'm just trying to understand how does this fit into the Lucasness?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
I mean, I think it fits in sort of perfectly, because, you know, our thing is always to come from a different angle on whatever genre, like whatever genre we're working in, we want to come from a different perspective. We want to do something that makes it new, or at least bold and fresh. And I think the with the Hampton thing, our biggest contribution is we said, let's go through the perspective of William O'Neill. Let's make this a story about the snitch. No one was thinking that. No one would even think that that's a reasonable thing to do, because it would have upset a lot of people. But I think in our minds, we're like, no, this will make this a classic film.
Yeah, I mean, we're even seeing, you know, through the internet and from reviews, like the biggest controversy so far is the fact that it comes from the perspective of the snitch.
Yes, it does bother me to some extent that the informant is a bigger character than this amazing person.
But he's not a bigger character. He's not a bigger character. Hampton drives the story. Hampton is ubiquitous from the very first frame to the very ending of it. Like Hampton's he's so mythological that you can't help but feel his presence in every scene. Yes, I think how we enter the story is through William O'Neill, but in terms of the more important character, in terms of just like importance to history, obviously is Hampton. But I think in terms of telling a story in a film, you have to make choices, right? Do you want to do the cradle to the grave traditional by the numbers biopic that we've seen before, that we're tired of? Or do you want to make something that's a bit more genre bending? And I think that our goal was to make Hampton's story a bit more of a genre bending biopic as opposed to a traditional one.
I think what the things that lands for me when I get to the end of the piece, and I'm assuming the audience has seen the film, is Bill O'Neill enough of a villain and a Judas, right? Because this is what the piece is, right? We have the Black Messiah and the Judas, right? Yeah. And his place as a heroic figure is Clint. He's great politically. He's great romantically. Like, right. I mean, everybody's going to love the hell, right? He just saves cats in every scene. We just love the hell out of out of Chairman Fred.
Right.
But I'm like, is Bill enough of a villain? Is he that? Is he really, like, because the infiltrators would lie, would cheat, would steal, would make them look worse than they were. Right. And he wasn't really doing that. So let's talk about that. Like, is he enough of a villain?
I would say yes. I mean, look, he pretended to. Well, he organized the shootout, but he basically facilitated the shootout first by giving the information about George Sams, and then by fucking pretending to be the sniper. All that shit was done by him. He wanted to do the C4 action. I think that he was.
And he also poisoned Fred Hampton. which eventually led to his assassination. Like, I would say, he's absolutely the villain, but he's also an agent of the state. The state is the real villain, right? The FBI, the FBI, Mayor Daley, Hanrahan, Hoover—they're the real villains. And Bill O'Neill is an agent for them. He's working for them. He's their proxy essentially. And I would say unequivocally that makes him the villain, or at least one of the villains in a larger story.
He's certainly the villain. I wanted to see more just dirt dumped on top of him. And when you get to the end and he's like, well, I had a point of view. I joined the struggle. Right. I was like, wait, nigga, you think you were in the struggle?
He does.
He believed it. But he was conflicted. I think that's the beauty of, I mean, that's the beauty and the tragedy of the story is that, like, you hear this guy, you see him, and you're like, wait a second, does he really believe that he was a part of the struggle? Or is he lying to save face? And then internally, he really just wants to kill himself. So it's like, I think that's part of the power and going from the perspective of Bill O'Neill is that he's so duplicitous and he lies to himself. And then he ultimately kills himself. And I think that you juxtapose that with someone like Fred Hampton, who was so self-assured, so committed to his principles, so committed to the I think you have a more powerful story. You're actually examining the souls of people. You're not just looking at, you know, the Hampton side of it, but you're looking at the Bill O'Neill side of it, because we've all met people who are more like Bill O'Neill than like Fred Hampton, I'm sure.
Sure.
And I think this is, you want to examine that.
And he does it for so little. It's not right. Like, like even in Queen and Slim, the brother cakes up for selling them right. out. He right. just right. like, he gets $200,000 over time. Mm-hmm. But like right. when they give him the a couple of bucks at the end and the keys to a gas station, I was like, damn, nigga, you sold them out for peanuts.
Yeah, peanuts.
But that elevates the story a bit, because it's like yes. the tragedy, because it's like Hampton died for that. Like yes. this great figure died for that. Like that's like, it just sickens you. You can't help but feel sick to your stomach.
What else do you know about Bill O'Neill that maybe isn't on the page? Because he's not. He has no, like, Hampton has a life, had other people in his family who he goes to, you know, he's growing a family. So mm-hmm. we get to know him as a person. Bill O'Neill is just a worker. He never, right? He never goes home, mm-hmm. right? He, as far as the film shows, he doesn't have a mom or a girlfriend or whatever. So, like, who is he as a person in this society?
Well, I mean, I think when he was doing his undercover work, he wasn't really involved with many people. I don't know when he got outside of it. He did get married. He had kids. He had an uncle. He moved to California briefly, and then he migrated back to Chicago. I think he probably escaped from Chicago because he had like probably death threats and stuff like that. So he probably escaped to Cali. But then he came back to Chicago in the mid to late 80s. Mm-hmm. And he lived with his wife and kids.
But I think in a film, he sort of represents the audience, right? You're sort of like, you come into the film and you have a conflicted viewpoint about the Panthers, you know, based on how Hollywood has treated them over the years. And not just Hollywood, but, you know, the media in general. You know, they painted the Panthers as this terrorist organization that was very militant, and they had guns and they shot up things, and that was about it. But you don't really see a full picture of them. And I think by going through, coming through the perspective of Will, and, you know, coming into seeing that the Panthers be a more robust organization, you hope that the audience starts to, you know, change in terms of their position on the Panthers. But obviously in the film, it doesn't have an impact on Bill O'Neill, but you hope that the audience has more of an impact on the audience, at least.
I mean, I wondered if he felt torn, because he was in the group and he does start to see like, wow, they are doing like really good things. They are, you know, I'm down for this. He's definitely helping the cause at some level. He's hurting them even more, but he's definitely doing the work and helping them.
Did we talk about this? I don't know if we talked about this before, but this, you know, Ernest Withers, the photographer for the civil rights. You ever see that? I have a dream picture of King okay. waving back, that okay. very iconic photo, right?
Yeah.
So Ernest Withers took that photo. He's pretty much known as the father of the civil rights photography. Just I am a man. All of that photography, amazing work, captured the movement. I think it's going to stand the test of time, even after we're dead. You're going to see those photos. Turns out he was an informant for the FBI, right?
What?
So he was an informant for the FBI. So this goes to your thing. He did work for the movement. I think he did marvelous work for the movement. I'm talking like pristine photography.
Yeah.
He's an informant. How the hell do you fucking balance that? How do you balance that? Like, how do you balance those two contradictory
positions? Cognitive dissonance must have been crazy. Of like, right. I actually like these people,
right.
and I believe what they're doing, and I'm still
right.
But it's, right. I mean, it's a very American story, you know. You know, the American ethos for the most part is rugged individualism. Pull yourself up from your bootstrap. It's very like self-interested, the individual
self-preservation,
and I think Bill O'Neill is a very American character. You know,
one thing with self-preservation And from, because I mean, I have Panthers in my family. I've read a lot about them. You know, it's one of my favorite parts of that, the resistance. They were extraordinarily on guard for infiltration. They knew the pigs are constantly trying to infiltrate us. So just even the whisper that somebody might have been with the police was enough to get you pushed in the corner or completely excommunicated. Mm-hmm. And when they meet with the Crowns, and the Crowns make him think like he's a cop, and they're like, and his response is kind of like, yeah, I mean, like, he's kind of telling the truth, but it doesn't sound like the truth. It sounds like a lie. And I was like, they would have been like, nigga, fuck you. Get the fuck out of here. Like, we don't trust you anymore. And, like, he skirts out of, like, if he came with, like, bam, here's my story, they'd be like, okay, but his story is janky. I'm like, the Panthers, who I know in my life and in history, would have been like, nigga, you got to get to step in, man. We can't trust you anymore.
Right. I mean, based on some of the, you know, eyewitness conversations about, you know, Bill O'Neill, I think that a lot of them were skeptical of Bill O'Neill. I don't think that they were convinced he was, and I don't think that they were so like convinced that he was a committed Panther that they weren't a little wary of him. I think that some of his actions were a bit outrageous. Like he built electric chair to electrocute potential snitches. I mean, Fred tore it down and said, there's no way they can do that. But I think that he had done some very extreme things for them to be like, you know, be wary of this guy. What I'm guessing is they didn't think he was that deep with the FBI. I mean, no one really.
Because he was committing crime. You know what I mean? Like, there were moments when he committed crimes. And I guess in their mind, it's like, if he's committing crimes, then there's no way he's a police officer, because they just don't do that. So I think a lot of it was he's going so far beyond what you're supposed to be doing that it sort of made them think that he wasn't an informant.
I think people just thought he was crazy, but I don't think they thought he was. I mean, I don't think they trusted him, but I don't think they thought he was like a informant. I think they probably just thought he was insane.
So I want to come back to this, but who is the Lil Rel character? who is he?
Some people are calling him the FBI pimp.
So just informants are everywhere.
Yeah. But that, I mean, I think that, you know, when people look back and study the COINTELPRO and what they called the FBI called it the ghetto informant program, but there were 7,000 snitches, 7,000, you know, folks throughout the country, 7,000 plus throughout the country. And you just never knew. You never knew who was an informant. I mean, they really played us against one another. Mm-hmm. I think it's captured perfectly in the script. I mean, I think they did a great job in capturing that in the script. And, you know, Shaka did a great job capturing it in the movie.
I mean, that's a moment where you're like, what is happening here? Right. What is going on? Oh, my God.
But I think it's like, you know, the George Sam's part of it, which is a true story. It's like, I think it's like, you want to play on that paranoia, like who's an informant, who might not be an informant, where are they? Like the George Sam shit, when we found out about that, it blew our minds. It was like, I can't believe they have another informant who killed a person that they said was an informant. It's like the FBI was really on some psychological warfare shit.
And used him to then be able to infiltrate everyone. Now that moment when Lakeith's Bill hears of what they did to another informant, you really see on his face and in his body how he's torn how he's lying to them about, like, yeah, I would have done such and such. I would have killed that nigga. We should kill these stitches. And, like, you see, like, oh, he's shook, but he's praying. Like, as an actor, like, that's one of his great moments in the film.
Agreed.
Where he really exudes two feelings at once.
Right. And I mean I believe that was improv. That wasn't in the script. I think how he went off and just sort of you see the fear. You feel it. And it's just like he's such a subtle actor, man.
Yes. I think one of the other great moments in the script, I mean there's a lot of great moments in the script, but when Hoover is like, So what are you going to do when your daughter brings home a Negro?
Right.
And like, you kind of get at like the heart of what a lot of this racial paranoia is about,
right,
for people like them and for a lot of white, mm-hmm, people. Like we don't want parity. We don't want them in our family. We don't want them with our daughters. We don't want them taking our jobs. We, mm-hmm, don't want them to our way of life, i.e. white supremacy, is at stake, right? Mm-hmm. And Fred Hampton is the tip of the spear, and right, we have to cut this off. And like, I thought that was a really, really amazing, important conversation.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, when Burson wrote his script, it was a lot of Hoover, and the way he characterized Hoover is a way I hadn't seen in a long time. Just like, mm-hmm, you know, even you've seen some portrayals of him as being kind of icky, but not like, mm-hmm, to the point where he's just like so. Bit of a monster, you know, bit of a just, yeah, like a cartoon monster who's racially driven. And, mm-hmm, yeah, seeing that play out and seeing it in the movie and reading it in the script for the first time, it was just like, yeah, they really.
I think we really wanted to go for making the FBI seem like they were gangsters. Like we wanted that was the crime element that we wanted to invert. Like usually when you watch a crime drama, the police officers are straight and narrow and they're good guys and the gang members are the bad guys. But in this shit, it's like we flipped it. We made the cops the gangsters. Like, mm-hmm, literally the final set piece, they bang into the house with a fucking Tommy gun on some sugar. Like, and it takes place in Chicago, which I think is beautiful because of their history of organized crime.
Right,
going
right.
back to fucking Al Capone.
And you see Roy Mitchell, he has a cigar in his mouth and he's just a straight gangster.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when it's totally gangster, when we get the close up on the sister and they are commenting that Fred Hampton is still alive,
mm-hmm,
and they shoot him.
And that's true.
Now he's good and dead.
And that's, mm-hmm, those are actual words.
Yeah. 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 You know, I mean, I've read the story. I mean, like,
oh, yeah, you know, yeah.
It freaking is so gangster. Right, I mean, like, menace to society. Like, is he dead? Shoot him again.
Right.
And I couldn't even imagine
two shots.
How she's feeling,
right,
carrying his baby, and she listens to him being murdered. Like, he's still alive. Now he's not. Like,
yeah.
Oh my,
yeah,
God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's America. I mean, it's the American government. They're so gangster, and they project. You know, they project all of their
neuroses and
neuroses on us, and they're afraid of us. But I'm like, you guys are the biggest gangsters. You guys can literally walk into a person's home and just kill them dead in front of their pregnant girlfriend, and then just go on with your day. Like, that's some gangster shit.
Right. And pay $1.5 million years and years later
after all that fighting. You know, after all the courtroom battles, like that $1.5 million that probably went to.
Think about this. The state paid. They pay William O'Neill a quarter of $1 million to do what he did. Who knows how much money they spent on surveillance of Fred Hampton, bugging him and keeping agents on him and spying on him and all. So I'm guessing the operation must have cost millions of dollars. So they spent $1 million to kill him, and then they spent another $1.7 million to pay the family for killing him. So in total, they spent almost $3 million to spy on a person and then pay the family out. They spent $3 million for that.
Right, spend more money on the spying.
And now multiply that across the country. Like,
yeah,
they probably, yeah, spent maybe $50 to $100 million spying and killing Black people.
I mean, that's they were crazy. Definitely spying on Malcolm just, yep, the same. They were spying on Martin. King just, yep, the same. They're, yep, spying on Huey and Eldridge and them, just the Bobby, yeah, Seale, just the same.
Yep. Yep.
It was a budget. Like, they had a budget in the,
yeah. You know what?
Agriculture,
you know what?
One
thing I wanted Bill O'Neill to kill himself on screen and for not to be a card, you know? And I like, that would have perhaps made me feel more like, okay, the traitor got what he deserved by his own hand. His guilt is so, like, watch Eyes on the Prize, turn that shit off, go in the room and freaking shoot yourself in the head.
Yeah, I mean, that was a conversation. Do we visualize O'Neill's death. I think there were a lot of things that probably would have been tough to do. You have to introduce another character with the uncle. You gotta film a fucking guy getting hit by a car. You know, like, that's expensive. You got to get the highway. You got to, like, it's just a much more expensive scene.
Wait, what are you saying? How did he kill himself?
He ran into the highway.
He ran into the expressway and killed himself. Like, he jumped in front of a car while a bunch of cars were driving by. He just ran into one.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective, and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
So you thought about, do we show this on screen?
I think when we were putting together the outline, yeah, we definitely thought we were going to show his death. But I think, you know, through the script and then finally getting to shooting it, it would have been very expensive. Very expensive, and I think also gruesome. And I don't know. I mean, it's one of those scenes where it's like I like how we ended it. I think the editors and I think Shaka did a great job in just like making sure we ended on Hampton and giving his speech and just a bit more hopeful.
Well, I think ending it on actual footage of Hampton is of course the right note.
Right.
And it takes us upward. Mm-hmm. I long for the other ending of Get Out. Like I want the dark, you know, Blackness is hard. Like, right, you know, Will O'Neill kills him. So he jumps in front of a truck.
Yeah, but you know, in one of the first cuts of the film, you know, ended with Bill O'Neill committed suicide. That's it. And then it was, you know, credits, and people were just like, "This is." It wasn't even just him get murdered. It was just Bill O'Neill committed suicide. Then the music came on, and then that was it. And people were like, "This is the most depressing." film I've ever seen. And so, like, you know, it was a lot of back and forth between the studio and just making sure, you know, I think it's right to lead with Hampton because, you know, he's such a powerful speaker. You want to see him.
I mean, in a Hollywood movie, we can't have them walk out of the theater depressed. You got to walk out happy so he can tell everybody.
Not even
great.
Happy, but just like hopeful. Like, because it's such a depressing. Like all of it's depressing. And then it's like, right. You know, I'm glad they went with Hampton at the end.
There's depressing elements. But I am definitely lifted by Dan Kaluuya's portrayal of Hampton.
Yeah, yeah.
He's
so
powerful. He's so inspiring. The speech where he's talking about you can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder a revolution.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I could watch that speech over and over. Like, that was just so powerful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were on set when they filmed that scene. And, you know, just being there and like feeling that energy at the time and just looking at the faces of all the people on the set. They're just like, we probably just witnessed one of the greatest things we're ever going to witness in our lives.
No, I think we're watching a man win an Academy Award. I think that, cause you talk about those things and you're like, oh, this guy could win an Academy Award. I was like, oh no, this is legitimately what it takes to get it. And we're literally front row seat. And it was great because it was performance. It was like him on stage. So you're like, I'm used to performing. They're never like that, but I'm used to doing it. I know the difficulty of doing it. And the way he was acting, you could see that he was struggling with that. Like, he was literally in performance mode. You can just, like, his face was going, like, even though he's reading lines, like, you can still see that he is in it. Like, he is.
Right. And he perfectly embodied the essence of Fred Hampton. Like, you know, we read all these books about Hampton and his speeches, and you actually see some of his speeches online. And you see how how captivated the audiences are when they see this man speak. And in that very moment, it felt like we were transported back to the late 60s. And we were literally watching Fred Hampton speak at the church. And he I don't know. You just feel chills. Even when I watch it now, I feel chills thinking about shooting that scene.
Did he? Right. Well, let's talk about shooting the scene for a second, because did he like just do it like once or twice with like a bunch of cameras, or were there lots of cuts?
So it was a lot to cover. I mean, he did it multiple times. He did the speech multiple times. So like in the very first one, we gave him a standing ovation, you know, but he had to keep doing it because they had to cover Deb. They had to cover Bill. They had to cover Roy Mitchell. So like it was a lot of it was a very difficult scene to shoot. So hats off to Shaka and Sean Bobbitt and the rest of the team. That's a very difficult scene to
shoot.
Very
complex
all day. And you have a full audience, so you have to cover them too. You have the drummers you need to cover. Like it was a lot of coverage. And he had to do that speech multiple times. So
he was every time he gave the speech, it didn't matter if he was on camera or if we were covering Deb or if we were covering, he still delivered it with the same exact precision and the same tone and the same amount of energy. I've never seen anything like that. Like, I'm like, this is true performing. Like, this is like, this man is at another level. I didn't know how he did it. I had no idea what I was watching, but when I saw it, I was like, oh, that's acting. That is acting.
It was breathtaking. It was breathtaking to witness, to see someone who, in fact, I don't know, like, this is one of his greatest performances of all time, but, you know, there's probably another level for him to reach, but I felt like Fred Hampton and playing Fred Hampton unlocked something that we had never seen in Kaluuya before. Even with Get Out, he was a bit more restrained, but here it was like he was unleashed completely. It was like,
Kaluuya, let me approach an issue that is going around, because Kaluuya is one of the greatest actors working today, just period. So you could hardly, I can't think quickly of like, why don't you get this person? But there is this thing among African-American actors where they say, why do Hollywood keep giving black African-American historical icon roles to British actors, right? And you see this with—
I think we have to ask ourselves, is that true?
Well, Cynthia Erivo plays Harriet Tubman.
It's happened a few times, but
King is played by David O'Elio.
Thurgood Marshall, Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, it's happened a bunch.
No, I agree. It's happened, but I feel like I think our situation is a little different because Kaluuya is otherworldly.
Yes.
He's otherworldly.
Cynthia's
great too. Don't get me wrong. I think Cynthia's phenomenal. I think she's a fantastic actress. And I think she did a great job as Harriet. I'm not trying to disrespect her. I think she's great. I'm just talking about the point I'm trying to make is that when you're casting for Fred Hampton, you want to make sure that the actor that you pick to portray him can embody the spirit and the charisma and all of that.
And also handle the complexity of the role and handle right. the complexity of filmmaking and handle the dense nature of the storytelling and who you can trust is going to commit themselves to the role. And I'm saying we know Kaluuya can do that. And that's not to say that an African-American actor can't do that, because I'm sure there are plenty of African-American actors who we probably could have gone to who would have done the work. But I think we did the right thing by going with Kaluuya, because I think he just went to another level.
I'm not going to lie. When Kaluuya was the first person Shaka thought of, and he wasn't the first person I thought of. I wasn't thinking Dane Kaluuya.
Did you have an actor in mind?
We had a couple people that we were thinking about. We were thinking Stephen James he played Jackie Robinson, right? No, not Jackie Robinson. He played what's the runner?
Jesse Owens.
He played Jesse Owens, and he was in If Beale Street Can Talk. We were kind of thinking him, but when Shaka put forth Kaluuya, I couldn't think of anyone else. Once he said Kaluuya, and I was like, yeah, I guess I do see Kaluuya. And then because we saw Kaluuya in Get Out. We saw him in Black
Widows.
He was in Widows. I never seen like a big performance from a larger than life performance from Kaluuya. Like Get Out, I think he was perfect in it. But when I'm thinking about Hampton, I didn't see it at first, and then Shaka really he made the case, and I can't see any other person playing
Hampton. I mean, he's also famous at a level that like of course there's a Jamie Foxx, Denzel level, but those folks are a little too old. Mm-hmm, but I mean, he is very famous in that he's going to draw people to the project in a way that, there's a lot of actors who are his age and younger who aren't that level of fame. Right. Half of the battle of casting is like, can you get people to come see the thing?
Right. Absolutely. Right. I think Shaka intuitively knew that. That's something I wasn't thinking about. But like, yeah, it's like Kaluuya's a name. He has an Oscar nomination. He's also an otherworldly actor, but like he also has these other attributes that would certainly help our film. And I think it has helped our film. I mean,
was Lakeith always in your mind for Bill, or did you have somebody else that we were thinking about?
We were thinking Lakeith. Mm-hmm. And I think Shaka definitely agreed. And yeah, Lakeith was, I don't think, did we think of anyone else for?
No, it was Lakeith from the beginning. Yeah, we were like, we had Lakeith in mind. We wrote it with Lakeith in mind. And I think they scripted it with Lakeith in mind. Like it was always Lakeith.
I mean, such a great actor. Just
phenomenal.
He's otherworldly.
He's so good.
What was the performance of Lakeith's that made you say, yep, this is the guy for our thing? Because you were thinking about this before he was famous.
Yeah, right. It was Jimmy Lee.
Right,
Selma. I saw Selma in
Get Out too. He was great in Get Out.
He was great in Get Out. But I was that scene with him as Jimmy Lee, really just like I was like, oh man, like he wasn't in it for long. He wasn't in the film for long, but that scene made me cry, and I was just like, man, he has a gift. He has a gift to like move you, but in a brief moment. Obviously, when he was in Get Out, it was just like in Atlanta, those two things that kind of put him at the top. But like seeing him as Jimmy Lee and Selma was the thing that really like put him on my radar.
Mm-hmm. And Lil Rel in this, he's brief. I know we touched on it before. He's brief, but he's powerful, man. He sprinkles, it's like, you know, no small actors, you know, that whole thing, like, right. No small roles. You know, I mean, he's powerful in this.
big ups to casting, man. You know, Rael is a very talented guy, and I don't think he gets enough credit for his dramatic chops. Because he was able to convey. Obviously, he was somewhat humorous, but he was also incredibly scary.
Right.
I mean, you know, he had a couple other scenes in there too that were great that didn't make it into the film.
Tell me about a scene or a part of the story that you loved that got cut out for whatever reason. And you're like, you know, I know we talked about the money angle,
right?
But like, there's always something that you like, we got to leave it out.
I think we can, maybe we can't all agree on this, but there's one scene in particular. So, in it, you know, after Lakeith or after Bill O'Neill says, let's bomb City Hall. Like we got C4, we can go bomb him. He gets in the original version of the film, he gets kicked out of the Panthers. Mm-hmm. Fred kicks him out and says, we don't want you to be in our group any longer. So he's like, I'm out. I did it. I'm gone. He's happy that he's no longer in it. But then Roy Mitchell tells him, we need you to go back to the go back to Hampton's house and poison him, essentially. And so he has to go back to the house, and he gets to the front steps, and he basically has to beg his way back into the house. And so there's one scene where Shaka and Bobbitt, they shoot it. It's like an overhead shot, and you have Hampton, you know, standing up tall, and then you have Bill O'Neill, sort of, you just have a shot of his face, and he's crying. He's in full tears, crying and begging Hampton to come back in. And he talks about how mad he was that the cops, you know, killed Winters, and how mad he was that the cops killed Jimmy Palmer. And he's just, he was so angry. And it's one of the best performances I've ever seen. It's just like, you at that point, you're like, is he really sad that about this shit, or is he just acting to get into the house?
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
Either way, he's knocking it out of the park. It's one of the greatest things. I hope that they release it on the director's cut, but like, it's one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen. It's one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen. And I think that one of the greater moments of Lakeith in that character, where he's like, you're like, what the fuck is going on? I'm watching this guy cry and say all the stuff that he thinks he believes, but ultimately he's going in there to betray Hampton. But we had to cut that out.
Beautiful. What's up with the brother who has rabble rouser carved into his chest in the prison? Mm-hmm. What's the story of that?
Well, I mean, what was it? I don't know that one. I mean, I know that we wanted to show the brutality of prison, and it was a larger thing happening at the prison.
Right. In the initial script, you know, Will and Shaka, there was a more expansive prison scene, and it was about like Hampton trying to get a letter to Deb, but also we wanted to show Hampton sort of bringing the prison together to not necessarily overthrow the prison guards, but you know, basically recruit them to join the Panthers. And I think they wanted to show that person to sort of inspire the recruitment, but we couldn't really get into detail about the rebel rouser. We couldn't go into we had to cut some of the prison stuff. We had to, because it was just like, it's too, not that it was too long, but we just had to cut. I mean, for time.
But in your mind, rabble rouser was written on him by the police.
Yes.
As a message to Hampton and everyone else there. Like,
right. It was written on by the police for sure.
I felt so bad for him.
Yeah. I mean, I totally forgot about that from the script. And so when I saw it, you know, in the film, I was just like, jeez, that's harsh. But I think Shaka did the right. He wanted to capture the brutality of prison, but there's only so many scenes we could do in the prison. So I think that showing that one dude was enough for people to be like, holy shit, this is...
Yeah, shit is real in there. Shit is fucked up in there. Did y'all think about taking a cameo?
No. I mean, I felt like we could have if we really like pushed it, but I'm like, I don't know. It just didn't feel... I don't know. It just didn't feel right.
It kind of break the fourth wall a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Two twins in a war zone probably takes you away from reality. So it's like part of, for me at least, I kind of like being behind the scenes sometimes. I like it's a little bit more mysterious. It's a little bit more like, how do these dudes get involved?
You're a celebrity. Everything has been about like you made a show, an animated show about you.
I know. But that's like, why this transition for me is like, it's important for me not to like, I don't know. It wasn't about my face being on the screen. It was more about the idea that we had permeating into this huge film.
I mean, I feel you in terms of like, you don't break the dream, right? Like the dream of cinema. Like I'm in this world and like sometimes, you know, I mean, sometimes those cameos are fun and sometimes it's like, oh, look, it's the writers of the film the film. Like,
right.
I feel you. So wait, is there another film in the pipeline?
About Hampton?
No, another Lucas Brothers movie.
Oh. Yeah. So we're working on a film with Lord and Miller. We're working on a script. They did 22 Jump Street. And we're putting something together. We're working with Seth MacFarlane on Revenge of the Nerds. Mm-hmm. Where we're going to be writing the script and starring in that. And we're doing some other stuff with at Universal.
Yo, I saw the original Revenge of the Nerds, man. That shit was fucking hysterical and powerful. And like, I'm surprised it hasn't been remade already. So, you know, that's a...
They tried to do it and they failed. So we're going to
some problematic scenes in the first one. So people have been like, I don't know. But I think we have a take on it that sort of... That will allow us to deconstruct the original one, but also
when the original one came out, the idea, like, nerds were really like the bottom of the social pyramid, mm-hmm. period, end of story. And right. in the decades since then, like, everything's up for grabs. Like, the nerds mm-hmm. might be the billionaires. They might be your boss. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you guys are rolling with a nerd aesthetic, like, proudly. Like, it's not, like, just bad. Like, you could be a bad nerd. You could be a cool nerd. Like, right. it's, like, that, everything has totally changed.
Right. I mean, that's part of the, that's baked in sort of the you know, the script, right? Like, the whole idea of nerd culture has evolved since the 80s, right? Like, nerds, right. they dominate. They are the bullies now.
Right.
They have all of the power, so you can't make a movie about nerds not being in power. So in our take, they are the powerful ones. They are the bullies.
So a 9-year journey from conception to getting this on a screen. What have you learned about storytelling that you'll take forward with you as you tell more stories?
There is a fundamental difference between, you know, pure storytelling, unfiltered by any sort of third party, any sort of commercial aspect. And then there's like mass marketed, filtered storytelling that has to go out to through a studio and has to have like large distribution deals. And then like, if you want your storytelling to be awarded with, you know, accolades at the end, there's another extended process that goes into it. So if you want to tell stories at the highest level, and I think we've come to an agreement that cinema might be the highest level, then you have to be willing to make concessions. You have to be willing to take into consideration opinions that may not necessarily, you know, cohere with what you think the movie should be. But if you can get to the finish line, if you can get there, there's nothing more beautiful to see people watch it, to see people process it, to see people in their different takes. There is nothing more beautiful than that.
And to Kenny's point, I think that, you know, when you're thinking about storytelling in a vacuum, you know, you're just like, okay, I have my idea. You know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get it done. But I think what I've learned is like the importance of collaboration.
Right.
You know, so many different people bring different ideas, and they brought different ideas to the making of this story. And I mm-hmm. got to see it from the beginning to right now. And it's like every time a new piece was added, you know, the story evolved. And every time a new piece was added, you know, we had to hear different ideas and different beliefs and different visions, but it all coalesced, I think, to make this film what it is. And I truly, truly believe in the art of collaboration. I think that, and you see it a lot in a lot of big Hollywood films. Like, you know, I read this book about Chinatown, mm-hmm. and, you know, it started off with Robert Town. He was writing the script, but then, you know, they brought in Jack Nicholson. They brought in Polanski. I know we can't say his name anymore, but they brought in him, and they brought in the producer, and they brought in all these different people to craft this story. And the same thing happened with us. Like we got in, we brought in Shaka, then Will Burson came in, then Ryan Coogler, then Charles King, then the Panthers themselves. Like, all these people played a role in making this film. And I think that, like, if you want to be a person in his industry, you have to commit yourself to the art of collaboration, and you have to commit yourself to the art of hearing different ideas and working together as a team to get things done.
Yeah, I think both of you kind of said the same thing in different ways in terms of collaboration, concessions. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you saying we have to figure out as Black storytellers how to tell a story in a way that white people will want to finance and watch?
No, not necessarily, because, you know, with our film, Charles King put up half of the funding. He's a Black guy. So we were able to get funding
Macro.
Mostly from Macro and a Black person. And even with WB, you know, we have.
But he's doing that because he anticipates a return. He's not a not-for-profit, right? He's not a philanthropist.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, like, I don't think we have to think so much about how do we get our stories made by convincing a white audience. I think we have to tell ourselves, how do we get our stories made by making the best version of this story. And I think, you know, collaborating with Shaka, collaborating with Kugler, collaborating with Burson, and doing our best to make sure we tell this story the most accurate way that we can, obviously taking some creative liberties. But I think that Charles was attracted to it, not because of what he could gain financially. I think he was attracted to the story because of how committed we were to telling it in its most honest way. And I mean, obviously, they probably saw the potential of it, but I don't think it's hard for me to think that that's what Charles King is like.
No,
that's what he's basing his calculus off of, because you know these movies are tough to sell. They don't make $1 billion. You know what I mean?
Speaking of $1 billion movies, you did have somebody who did make a $1 billion movie on the team.
Right.
Ryan Coogler, what's it like working with him, and how, how is he able to help as a producer? Because I'm sure he's giving like creative ideas. Right. What's it like working with him? Because he's a monster.
I remember, so the script was sent out to, all of the producers, and we got notes back from Coogler, from Sev, from Charles, from the macro team, from Proximity. And, they work as a collective. I mean, it wasn't just like Coogler giving notes. It was his whole team giving notes. And then it wasn't just Charles giving notes. It was Charles and his team. So it was interesting to see how they work as a collective within their production companies, and just how they run things. I mean, And even like, but Coogler's notes in particular were very, very insightful. I mean, and I think he definitely worked closely with Shaka to make sure, the script was, being truthful and accurate. But also, and Shaka told me this story. He was like, the first script that they put together was a bit more robust. It was a bit more, a bit more comprehensive with, story. I mean, plots about how to get funding for the medical center. And then he said, Coogler told him, write the story that you guys pitched me. And they basically pitched him, the Departed mixed with the COINTELPRO. And they basically pitched him that story. And he basically told him, that's the story that we need to write. And so, I think that was the importance of Coogler. Coogler always—he's like a very insightful guy, and he has his eyes on the goal. And I think he was able to push the writers to tell the story that they eventually told. And I think that was in large part because he kind of sees—he just really understands the industry. He understands it. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of the writers understood. He has just a more. He just has a more. More. What's the word I'm looking for?
Expansive
because he's more experienced. I mean, he's been working at the highest level, making Black Panther, and also
he's also an auteur. He understands the filmmaking process more so than I think a lot of people. So
right. When was this shot? When was this shot?
This was shot. So we started filming in late 2019 in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. October to December.
Yeah.
Oh, back back when everything was normal.
Yeah.
Everything was normal. Yeah.
Right before.
Right. Like we started everything was normal. So when was it finished being edited?
Well, so Christian, he's our editor. He already started editing while we were filming, but I think Shaka got into the room around January and we were supposed to be done because, we didn't know about COVID. We were supposed to be done by August. But once COVID happened, that disrupted the edit. And so everyone they started editing remotely. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it got done until maybe like November, December. It was late.
Of 2020. Any disappointment in damn, it's not going to come out in the theater. I mean, it is out in the theaters, but really people are going to consume this via
right.
television, computers, rather than on the big screen. How does that hit you?
I think that I was initially very disappointed. I'm like, oh man, I wanted people to experience this in the cinema. But I think after the year that we've had with COVID and people dying and you know, this just the scourge of this disease, it's very hard to like be like, oh, I really want people to go to the theater to see this. I'm like, I just want to entertain people. I want people to watch something and take, if I can take their minds off of the reality of COVID for 2 hours and they feel something other than the fear of getting that disease, and I feel like I've done a service. And I feel that's way more important now than satisfying whatever sort of ego trip I would have had putting it in the cinema.
Yeah, ultimately you want people to see the film, learn something, absorb the message, and I mean, how they see it, I'm a big theater guy. I love going to the movie theater. I love seeing films on the big screen, but ultimately, like, I just want people to see the film by any means necessary. I want to get Brad's story out there, and I want to get his message out there. I'm already seeing people like starting to do more research about Fred Hampton and talk about him and you know, learn more about COINTELPRO. Like, there was a spike in Google searches for COINTELPRO. Like, that's what I want to see, and we're already seeing that. So I'm like, we served that purpose, and it doesn't matter how they see it. We just want people to see it.
Yeah, you've definitely entertained in the highest sense of that word, and also educated without it being didactic or like, exactly. Now we're going to tell you about the Panthers, you know, or it's like, it doesn't feel propagandistic, but it does like, look at the Panthers, like feeding children, like uniting the community, like chilling out the violence, like trying to help people, like, you know, being brought down by the fucking CIA and the FBI. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a great film. So, you know, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Y'all should be proud, you know,
super proud. And, again, I like to just give a shout out to everybody involved. I mean, cause it took a village to make the film. And, I'm glad that everyone's sort of getting recognized for their contributions, from costume to makeup to the writing, to the directing, to
the hat that Hampton is wearing in his first scene.
Oh my God.
The camo bucket hat. That's I'm so like, beautiful. Yo, where can I get that? I love that. And his hat is cocked aside. I'm like, yo, I'm about to love this character. Right, that bucket hat was something else, man.
It was insane.
Yeah, that was a costume designer, Charlize, man. She's so talented.
Real deal. Yeah.
She's so talented.
They looked good in terms of having the Panther look without it being cliche about it.
We've never seen that take before. You generally see them in like leather and beret, you know, the leather berets. But now it was like, you know, it was good to see Hampton just like, you know, I mean, obviously he had his military fatigues, but it was still like something we've never seen before on the screen. So like,
when Bill was saying, when Bill kind of breaks up with them, when he's saying, let's bomb City Hall, right? You know, you said kill them all, get total satisfaction. And when Daniel says kill them all, get total satisfaction, I love that line. is he saying, I hear you, let's go be the ultimate Panthers? Or is he saying, I am leading you into the trap to get you fucked?
I think it's the latter.
And Hampton sees that.
Hampton's too smart. I don't know if he sees him as a I don't know if he sees him as an informant, but he certainly sees him as someone whose decisions are going to lead to a lot more people getting murdered. I think Hampton was comfortable with himself dying for the cause, but I don't think he was comfortable with his members dying. I think he was committed to his principles, and you know, obviously he led by example, but I don't think he just wanted to lead his team to slaughter. You know, he believed in defense, self-defense, and defending yourself against police brutality, but just an attack on City Hall, that's terrorism, that's terrorist.
Thanks so much to the Lucas Brothers for a great interview. And thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Dr. Keena Murphy, and Earl Dorsey. Torre Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show and on Patreon at patreon.com/Torre Show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean, and we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we'll be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.